Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Asia Louie, and I'd like to welcome you to Understanding Deaths of Despair webinar. This webinar is brought to you by the SAMHSA Minority Fellowship Program Coordinating Center. We'd like to draw your attention to the disclaimer. The views, opinions, and content expressed in this presentation do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, or policies of the Center for Mental Health Services, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'd now like to introduce today's presenters. Dr. Faye Gary is the Medical Mutual of Ohio Kent W. Clapp Chair and Professor of Nursing, who also holds a secondary appointment in the Department of Psychiatry at the School of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Gary has studied and designed culturally relevant interventions for more than three decades and has researched the areas of health disparities in vulnerable populations. She has served on the NIH National Advisory Council on Minority Health and Health Disparities, the SAMHSA National Advisory Council, the NIH Roadmap Health Disparities Subwork Group, and a Joint Commission Expert Advisory Panel to guide the development of standards for culturally competent and patient-centered care. Dr. Gary is the founder and director of the Provost Scholars Program, a novel initiative that is a partnership between Case Western Reserve University and public schools that provides enhanced academic opportunities for youth and their families. She has published more than 120 research and scholarly papers and has received the Book of the Year Award from the American Nurses Association. Her work spans six continents and a variety of academic and practice settings. She is currently collaborating with colleagues to produce an interprofessional focused textbook on population health and health disparities. Our second presenter, Dr. Mona Hassan, received her doctorate degree from Case Western Reserve University, where her research focused on child maltreatment. During her tenure at Case Western, she acquired extensive knowledge and hands-on experiences in several area hospitals and clinics as a rape crisis center volunteer, and also worked to collect emergency department data on young people who were alleged victims of sexual abuse. Her research has been presented at several scientific conferences, and she has published numerous research articles on African American communities in Florida, Ohio, Haiti, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Dr. Hassan currently teaches family health nursing and research methods for undergraduate students in the College of Nursing at Prairie View A&M University. I will now turn it over to our speakers. Dr. Gary?
Thank you so very much. It is a pleasure to be here with my colleagues today, of whom I can't see, but whom I know toil every day to improve the human condition. Thank you for joining us. Today we will be discussing deaths of despair, and we have formulated four objectives. The fourth objective will be an area where we would ask you to participate and began to formulate what you think might be the next steps to reduce and eliminate deaths of despair or any level of despair. Today, we will be discussing some conceptual formulations related to deaths of despair, identify causes of death and despair, and you will hear me talk a lot about suicide, substance use abuse, and liver disease. However, the major weighting part of the discussion would be on suicide, because as you know, that is irreversible and final and also preventable. We will discuss despair among populations that have experienced this phenomenon for generations, but perhaps have not yet gotten the attention that they deserve so that they too can have a more fulfilling life. Deaths of despair is a relatively new concept that has recently entered the literature and certainly captured the attention of many researchers across the United States. What you need to remember is deaths of despair are linked to economic social determinants of health, particularly among rural white males. Again, I'm repeating, they include suicide, substance use and abuse, and liver disease, of course, which is related to the substance use abuse, including alcohol. And just as a brief introduction, we will play a brief video so that you can have more contextual information about deaths of despair. Please listen to the video. White individuals with a high school degree or less are experiencing higher rates of deaths than those with four-year degrees. This finding has brought attention to the social forces that create these deaths of despair, primarily among whites. In some regions of the United States, white middle-class men experienced a decline in health expectancy over the last numerous years, a phenomenon that had not existed before World War I. And just to help you understand the context, I'd like to share with you that World War I ended in 1918. That was the same year that the pandemic flu, or the Spanish flu, as it is sometimes referred to, emerged. Now, the Spanish flu is responsible for the lives of more than 50 million people worldwide. The world has not seen a pandemic such as the one we experience now since about 1918. So I just wanted to help put that into perspective so we can understand all of the dynamics that we are dealing with. The other piece of tidbit that I'd like to share with you is that the Spanish flu, also known as the 1918 flu, had nothing to do with Spain. In fact, it originated at Fort Riley, Kansas, at a military institution swept through the nation and then across the world. Deaths of despair is a concept that has been popularized by economists, and of course, Dr. King, who we just saw in the video at Princeton University, is an economist. And she and her colleagues suggest that the decrease in life expectancy of people in the United States is related to the rising rates of deaths caused by suicide, drug overdose, and alcohol-related conditions. Now, let's just dig a little deeper with that. Suicide, the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, taking the lives of about 45,000 people a year, to a 30% increase across half of the states in the United States in the past year. Now, the deaths that are related to drugs have tripled between 2010 and 2016. Associated with those deaths are liver diseases that have increased by 31% since 2000 and between 2000 and 2015 among populations aged 45 to 64 years of age. Another look at deaths of despair. This slide shows us the highest and lowest as experienced by states during the years 2005 and 2016. You would see from the slide that Nebraska has the lowest and West Virginia the highest. Now look to the left of your slide because those green bars indicate the combined conditions, the combined three conditions of which I speak are drug overdose, alcohol, and suicide. Now, if we go to the right of your screen, where the orange color is, you see Nebraska is still relatively low, and West Virginia is high. If you look at alcohol, you see that Nebraska is lower, and West Virginia is higher, even though the alcohol use is not as profound as the drug overdose. Of course, the suicide follows. Nebraska is lower, and West Virginia is a bit higher. When we look at deaths of despair, we are amazed at the fact that the leading causes of death in the United States are trending downward, except deaths of despair is trending upward. Now, this information comes from the Commonwealth Fund, published in 2017, where you see that heart disease decreased and deaths per 100,000. Cancer deaths per 100,000 decreased, stroke the same, lung disease, COPD. COPD is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, slight decrease. The next bar is deaths of despair, and you will see an increase. Diabetes, we had a slight decrease, and pneumonia and flu, a slight decrease. So of all of the major health conditions that we are trying to address in the United States, we are trending in the right direction, that is downward, except for disease of despair and those conditions that comprise our collective concept that we are calling disease of despair. Deaths from drug overdose double, and this accounts for a lot of the increase in disease of despair. So if you look at this top green line, again from the Commonwealth Fund, these data are 2018. Collectively, you'll see this line, again, we're talking about deaths per 100,000. Starting to the left, you will see the year 2005. And it's a steady trend line upward when we look at the combined rate of the three causes. It's a steady increase from 2005 to 2016. So the question then would be, what's driving that trend line upward? So if we look further down on the screen, you will see that orange line is drugs. And drugs is the lethal culprit that's driving it the most. Now, when we look at alcohol, which is the purple line, and suicide, which is the blue line, it's a very slight trend upward. But you see drugs is the driving force that leads to the contributions for creating deaths of despair. This is an interesting slide because we are looking at deaths of despair now by gender or by sex. Starting in 1999 to 2018, a continuous increase upward. Again, this is deaths by 100,000 populations, and males have had a continuous increase of deaths from overdose since 1999. Now, if we look at females, too, have been dying from deaths of overdoses of drugs. Of course, the trend line is not as intense, but what I want you to take a look at is the female and follow the yellow line all the way to 2005. And you will find that in about 2018, females have the same age-adjusted rates that males had in about 2005. These are some other details about suicide. Remember I told you that I was going to focus a lot on suicide because it's irreversible. It's a finality, and it's also a condition that if we're careful enough can be prevented. It's the 10th leading cause of death. I'm repeating myself for emphasis. On average, about 132 Americans die by suicide every day. By the same token, 1.4 million Americans attempt suicide. Now, if you look at the next block over, you will see that the second leading cause of death among certain ages, 10 to 34, that is amazing. This is, life is just beginning between the ages of 10 and 34. The fourth leading cause of death are among those individuals 35 to 54. It's the prime of one's life, and despair has taken over. We also know, and we have known for years, that men are more successful in committing suicide, but women make more frequent attempts. And I'd like to add that as a researcher, clinician, that I found that it's very tricky, and when females or males continue to manifest suicidal behaviors or threaten suicide, I consider them to be in the category of high lethality because they just might do it. I can recall, and I'm just going to give a quick vignette here. I can recall some years ago, a young lady coming into the emergency room. She's a very bright woman, a student at a university, and she had taken an overdose of some pills. And of course, you do know that one of the last senses to leave is hearing. And apparently, she had heard the staff who were taking care of her make comments about her inability to be successful with her suicidal act, or maybe it was hysterical act or whatever. And she didn't discuss that with anyone. But I guess it was maybe 2 or 3 months later, she came in where she almost died from a suicide attempt. So we have to, whatever that expression of behavior is, we have to consider it highly lethality and be sure that we never trivialize that for any reason. Now, I also need to just share with you that firearms account for slightly more than half of all suicide deaths. And yet, in our great nation, there is a certain kind of romantic affiliation with guns. The other thing that I need to impress from this data is that veterans have a higher rate of suicidal behaviors and actually are committing suicide than non-veterans. This is over the age of 18. We also now have a number that one can call to get help for suicidal behavior, suicidal activities, information, and that's 988. I want to stress among all of our participants today that you need to memorize this number, inculcate it in your daily activities so it's always near, because you'll never know when you'll need to use 988 and save someone's life. It's a new number, and we're trying to get the word out that this is the number one can call for help, and I'm happy that we now have it. If you want to see suicide rates in the United States, I think this is a good, quick way to do this. States in the top one-third of suicide rates in the United States are the heavy, heavy blue. And you can see how they almost kind of cluster together with a few outliers over here in West Virginia and up in New Hampshire. Now, states in the middle third of suicide rates in the United States are the ones with the blue that's just a bit darker. And they, in a sense, kind of cluster together somewhat. And, of course, it's my home state, Florida, is in this middle category. And then the states in the lower one-third with suicide rates are the ones with the lighter colors. And you can see that states in the top one-third are the largest. I think I counted about 17, maybe 18 states in this category, to include Alaska. If you look at suicide by age, suicide rates by age, again, this is per 100,000. For men, those men who are 65 years of age and older are at greater risk. But if you just let your eyes come all the way down to 45, 54, you see that they're high risk in that age too. And if you just look a little farther down, you see 27.0, 35, 44. These are relatively young people now. 65 is considered to be relatively young anymore. But yet it's the people are beginning to feel despair to the extent that their lives would be considered as a way to end the despair. Now, if you look at females, and that's to the left of your screen, you would see that the females who are at greatest risk are those females between the ages of 45 and 54. They are young women. They are heads of household. They are in the prime of their lives, their working lives. They are women taking care of parents, and they are women also with children and with grandchildren. So these are years wasted in terms of productivity and well-being, taken away, snipped away because of the despair, the ultimate of despair is indeed suicide. And this is now suicide by race. We've known for a long time, and we continue to see patterns of this behavior. American Indian, Alaska Native, if you look down at the bottom of the slide, you'll see a key that would help you to follow along. So we know American Indians and Alaska Natives, not Hispanic, especially the men, have the highest rates of suicide per 100,000. The women, the highest, 11.0 per 100,000, followed by white, non-Hispanic men, and then by white, non-Hispanic women. Again, as we look at policy, as we look at our research, as we do our teaching, participate in our clinical encounters every day, I think we need to just understand some broad demographic factors about the populations that we care for and what their risks are for certain kinds of conditions. Again, I'm going to discuss deaths of despair, and I'm switching now from white males, the general population, to a particular group of people. COVID-19 represents a catastrophic threat to Navajo Nation people in Arizona. We know that the Navajo Nation has higher rates per capita of suicide, other people in that state, and the national capital rate. The COVID infection is about 10 times that of Arizona's other population. When I say other population, I mean non-whites, or non-Native Americans, and they are predominantly whites, some Hispanics, and some blacks. So one of the reasons it's very high is the difficulty in being able to wash one's hands is a way you can transmit the virus. And this is a quote from a newspaper. It's really hard for families who don't have access to water to wash your hands for 20 seconds. And of course, that's what the CDC requires. 40 to 50% of Navajo homes have no running water. Inadequate water makes it impossible to follow the CDC guidelines to control the virus, and hand washing and wearing masks and distancing 6 feet away are the basic kinds of behaviors that need to be manifested in order to control this virus, which is deadly. Nevertheless, there's some people who cannot, not will not, but cannot follow the CDC guidelines. You also need to know that all homes in America within the reservation and across the nation do not have running water. American Indians live in homes, 12% of those homes have no running water, compared to other Americans where 0.6%. And I think these kinds of factors set up despair and set up situations that tend to interrupt the life course of people and certainly diminish the possibility that their well-being will be the best that it can be, and these individuals can make the best contributions that they're capable of making. All of that wanes, and not able to wash your hands is just one example of what begins to happen to interrupt people's lives. Just to go back and show you that these data about Native Americans and suicide is not new, I found this slide about young adults aged 18 to 24, and young adults aged 18 to 24 just emerging from late adolescence. And in fact, some definitions of late adolescence is up to age 26. So we can call it young adults, or we could call it late adolescence. Whatever your conceptualization is, we still see American Indian and Alaskan Natives, males and females, having the highest suicide rates in our nation, followed again by white men, white women. Deaths of despair among American Indian youth needs us to think about this in an alarming manner and respond. Even though we know that deaths of despair among white men and women must be addressed, and it's good to have it in the forefront and to understand what might be some of the driving factors. And we have identified that those driving factors for white men and white women are education levels, which helps to create the deaths of despair. I propose, or I hypothesize, we could use the same kind of assumption and underpinning to address deaths of despair among American Indian youth and others. American Indians have a suicide rate that is 50% higher than their white counterparts. Death rates attributed to liver disease is 5.2 times that of their white counterparts. Alcohol consumption remains a major public health problem among Native Americans. This information is not new, but the interventions that should follow and the steadfastness with which they should be addressed, I think, is what's missing. Just as a matter of reference, I've just identified the three major causes of death among African-American populations. They are heart disease, cancer, and accidents. Unintentional injury, which can consist of numerous kinds of acts, such as motorcycle accidents, car accidents, etc., etc. But heart disease and cancer are as major causes of death, do mirror the major causes of deaths of the majority of the American populations. If you were go to any major health science center in the United States, you will see the evidence of facilities to care for individuals with cardiovascular disease and cancer. I wanted to share with you some conceptual models. There are many, and this conceptual model is one of my favorite ones, and my colleagues, Dr. Hassan, that's Dr. Mona Hassan, who also is my co-presenter, and Dr. Jose Nirande, the three of us have done several publications together, and I think this might be Dr. Jose Nirande's favorite model. Now, I like this model because if you look at the model, you can talk you from the bottom. This is individual and population health. So what does that consist of? So the first three areas could be considered the macro piece. That's the individual, biologic, genetic structure. The next one, social relationships, living conditions, neighborhoods, and communities. That's the interpersonal, interactional piece. It's where one lives, where one works, play, and learn. And then you look at the macro, and the macro levels are the social and economic policies and the institutions, be them education institutions or hospitals or clinics or prisons, whatever, America's institutions. Now, engulfing it all is the life course. And for me, the life course begins before conception and ends at death. And the environment, again, is where one lives, learn, work, and play. It's the parks, it's the family, it's the church, it's the temple, it's the synagogue, it's your workplace, etc., etc. Now, I like this model because it reminds me of the systems theory. You can look at any one of these factors or variables, however you wish to set up your way of conceptualizing your work. That's your research work or your clinical work, and you can deal with any one of them. But I caution you that we cannot oversimplify either one because they all are interrelated, and in many ways, it's a systems approach. And unless we can clearly understand that individuals live in social relationships, they also live in neighborhoods, they also work in institutions, and they're governed by the social, economic, political, legal policies of our society. And we have to understand that collective concept as we go about trying to provide the best clinical care, best practices we can, the best research, and also advance the policies and the laws in a much more equitable kind of manner. Now, the next slide here is one that I use all the time, and I continually use it in my clinical teaching. Now, in this particular slide, and it comes from Smedley, Sith, and Nelson, and they are the individuals who wrote the book Unequal Treatment that was published in 2003, and it was commissioned by the United States Congress to try and help us understand what were some of the drivers that were creating and maintaining the disparities and unhealthy outcomes for so many American people. So if you look at the upper left part, which to me is probably the bedrock of it, it talks here or it presents here patient input. And that is, I call it the clinical encounter, but that is indeed the interaction between the patient, the client, and the provider, whomever you may be, psychologist, social worker, psychiatrist, nurse, whomever you may be. That is a major component of the clinical encounter and sets the stage for the health outcomes for the individual. So what happens here in the patient encounter? We get a medical history, and especially in psychiatry or behavioral health, where that our diagnosis is built heavily on what that history, that patient history is. How long have you had this? What has been the frequency of it? What have you done? How have you treated? What's been the outcome? And why do you come now is a question I always ask. So given this data and given other data such as blood test or urine test or sputum test or x-rays, MRIs, whatever, those data are fed into what I call the clinician's personal internal computer. But lurking above the clinician's internal computer are issues surrounding social, economic, and cultural values of the clinician and the perceived social, economic, and cultural influences the patient presents. It also involves money, whether you have insurance or not. It also involves your status in your community, the power that you have in your community, perceived or real. Now, underneath it all, lurking underneath, we have the conscious and unconscious stereotyping and the conscious and unconscious prejudice that all of us come with because we are human and we all have our life experiences that have helped to shape our values and how we weight certain values, our belief systems, etc., as well as our theoretical and academic education. So we take what's lurking above and what's lurking underneath, and it meets in the middle where we see interpretation of all of the data, the diagnostic entity, the interpretation of what I think, the interpretation of how I apply the DSM-5 or whatever else category I'm using. And then I begin to my data ready to present to a case conference or to make my own decision or to share it with colleagues. And we come up with a diagnosis and an intervention. And at best, we know that there is always a problem that this particular intervention would not work with this particular person. But there is, of course, the best practices that we use that are based on scientific data. And we utilize, or we should, and it is our best efforts to utilize cutting-edge research and practice guidelines. So when all of these components come together, we make a decision. And we share a decision to include that intervention for care with the patient and the family. Now, I'm just going to stop for a moment and share with you another little vignette. And this is I can call it a patient narrative, and it has to do with me. I went to see a clinician several years ago, and I shared what my problem was. Had never met the person before. The person had never met me before and got a little history and we did a little talk. And then he looked at me and he said, well, three things come to mind. I have A, we could do this. B, we could do this. And C, we could do this. But now C is a bit more complicated and I don't know if you'll be able to manage C. I don't know if you have the capacity to manage C. So let's just take that one off the table. So I said, well, please share with me what C might be. And C did require several steps to include something in the morning and something in the evening and X, Y, Z. He said, oh, you couldn't possibly manage that. That is too complex. So I think what I'll do is I will prescribe A. And so that was very concerning to me. So I asked, how is it that you make these decisions? And he said, oh, well, you know, it's been my experience that Black people don't follow through, they don't keep their appointments and whatever. So what he had done was to determine my capacity for self-care, for health literacy, to understand a course of treatment because of the skin I'm in. So I said to him, I will choose C. my right to have seed. And I said, I think I have also an obligation to share with you some literature so this won't happen with other people. And I did. I took him some books to read, and we had further conversations, and he apologized for that kind of behavior. And that's because I was able to say, sir, listen. But that's from the clinical encounter. That decision about me was made from the clinical encounter and the skin that I'm in. I'd like to also pause and say that race is a social construct, and it is a very powerful and influential social construct, whether you are a patient or a clinician, or a researcher or policy writer. I think we all must monitor very carefully our stereotyping, our prejudices, as we get more knowledge and we undergird ourselves with more theory and research. Nothing replaces the continuous self-monitoring of how we present ourselves to others and how we interact with others as they present themselves to us. I like this one. I think this also is Dr. Jose Nirande's, one of Dr. Jose Nirande's favorite one, and he suggested I include this one. Thank you, Dr. Nirande. This slide highlights the influence of stress. This comes from the National Institutes of Health. And if you look at the biological factors, and that's the genetics, that's our whole biological structure, the environment within which we live, be it where the toxic dumps are or be it next to a nice, lovely park with growing, flowering trees, the social environment within which we live, work, and play, and also the behavioral factors that we've learned over time with regard to health and interactions and survival modes. And the discrimination, perceived discrimination and actual discrimination. When we put these five areas collectively and apply them to disadvantaged groups, whatever group that might be, for you it might be the homeless. For someone else, it might be children who run away. For some of you, it might be children who are in the migrant camps. But whatever the disadvantaged groups are, this is the way that stress gets under the skin. This is the mechanism by which stress gets under the skin. Now, once stress gets under the skin, we have negative impact with the biological factors, the biological components, the endocrine system, the immune system that we hear a lot about now because of the virus. But the immune system needs to be healthy at all times. So once that disadvantage gets under the skin, then there's a possibility that the quality of one's life erodes. It's also the possibility that diseases will enter the body more regularly, that people will call in sick from work because they are, because the entire quality of life has been compromised. I'm just going to return here for just a moment and share with you another slide about alcohol use. And we have three categories. We have the current alcohol use, which is in the blue part of the bar, and it's very high among whites. And if you look at whites too, we look at binge drinking. It's very high, but not quite as high as Native Americans. If you look at heavy alcohol drinking, you see that's primarily, you're talking about whites and you're talking about Native Americans, Native Hawaiians, and other Pacific Islanders. So it's Native Hawaiians and other Pacific Islanders here. Of course, we're also talking about Black and African Americans that have pretty high levels of binge drinking as well. I'm going to discuss a particular study that my colleague, Dr. Jose Nirande and Dr. Mona Hassan and other colleagues have helped us to do. We had a cadre of very outstanding people in all three settings to help us with this study. This is a study about Black women in three communities. Three communities are Ohio. The little ring at the top is Ohio. The ring with the shape of Florida is Florida. And way down in the Caribbean is the Virgin Islands. These are the three communities that I will be discussing. We use the Beck Depression Test as one of several instruments with the study that we were doing. And this slide just shares with you the Beck Depression Scale classification among the three women. You can see from this scale that most of them had minimum scores in depression, a smaller number mild, even smaller number moderate and severe. We had Florida having just a bit of severe depression. I have another vignette to tell you, and this is from a clinician's perspective. When we were collecting the data in Florida, a lot of the individuals worked at hospitals, and they provided direct service to patients at hospitals. And this lady I had interviewed, and then we scored all of her items on the instruments. And I found that this particular lady had scored extremely high on the Beck Depression Scale. And we had asked the women if they wanted to get the results of the study, if we had information about them, we would mail it to them. And this particular person worked at a hospital. And when I saw the score, that there needed to be some additional intervention as written out in our informed consent. So I went looking for her, and I found her, and she was at work. Before I had any intervention, I went through the proper channels and talk with people at the facility and ask if I might see her, have a private conversation. So when I did interact with the lady, I said that I was concerned, et cetera, et cetera. And I had done the interview. All of us did face-to-face interviews. So somebody on the team knew her and had interviewed her. And anyway, when I said to her that I was concerned and I wanted to take some further action as we had written on the informed consent. And the lady said, I cannot afford to get off the clock. If I get off the clock and miss these hours, I won't have enough money to pay for my rent, to care for my family. So I'm sorry, but I can't get off the clock. I have to keep working. Of course, we managed to help her get the care. But my point to you is that individuals are so stressed economically, as is indicated by our colleagues from Princeton, that even getting off the clock to care for one's physical and mental health is a major decision. This is the education levels of the women in the three groups. You can see that start here with high school. We had the Florida group having the most high school degrees. Some college was Ohio. The highest in college degrees was the Virgin Islands, and college graduates was Ohio. We did a factor analysis with the Beck Depression Test. We were very concerned because the Beck Depression Test is one that we use. It has 21 items. It's one of the most frequently used tests to document depressive symptoms. Now, I make the point that we are talking about documenting depressive symptoms. It's not used as a diagnostic tool per se. It does is alert you to who you should do a more extensive clinical interview to decide if depression or some other illness condition is present. So with the help of Dr. Irande and Dr. Hazan, a factor analysis, just want to show you the items and their loadings on the Beck Depression Test. For the Florida group, the cognitive dimension, depression loaded at 0.81 level, worthlessness loaded at 0.7, punishment feelings at 0.65, that's the loading. Now, the cutoff point is 40 for both somatic and cognitive dimensions. So we stopped here at pass failure at 0.41, and you could see the others for yourself. Now, when we looked at somatic affective dimensions, which is factor 2, the factor 2 loading, which is in the blue, tiredness and fatigue, 0.76 loading, loss of energy, 0.62 loading, all the way down to loss of pleasure, 0.45, and all between. Now, this is the Florida group where we interviewed 206 women. Now we'll move on to, I think it's the Cleveland group. The Cleveland group, the factor loadings on the cognitive dimension, you see suicidal thoughts or wishes loaded at 0.81. the highest loading was suicidal thoughts. Past failures were 0.68 loading. Self-dislike loading at 0.66 all the way down to the cutoff point 0.40 sadness and all between. Now, the factors that loaded on somatic affective dimensions again are in the blue. For this group, we see irritability loading the highest at 0.65, changes in sleep patterns at 0.64, loss of energy 0.52, all the way down to agitation 0.43. The Virgin Islands group, here we interviewed 126 women, same methodology, same instruments. Oh, I also need to point out that all of the individuals who did the interviews were nurses and psychologists. So for the Virgin Islands group, the cognitive dimensions loadings were punishment feelings. The loading was 0.86. Self-criticism, the loading was 0.81. All the way down to our cutoff point, which was pessimism, loading at 0.46. Suicidal ideation, for an example, in the middle, loaded at 0.63. Somatic affective dimensions for the group included a loss of pleasure, loading at 0.73, changes in sleeping patterns, 0.63, irritability, 0.62, all the way down to change in appetite, cutoff point, and change of appetite, loaded at 0.42. Now, I showed you the results, mild, moderate scores. But when you look at the factor loadings, you understand the conditions, the psychological, physiological, cognitive dimensions, somatic affective dimensions of the population in a very different way, or of the sample. This is a sample. You can make generalizations to the population, but this is our sample. And Dr. Yaronde and Dr. Hossein and I found this to be quite intriguing. I'd like to also say that we have a paper that's coming out. I think Dr. Hassan told me it'll be out in 2 weeks, and we were looking at chronic stress and depression. And when Dr. Yaronde, who's a statistician par excellence at Wayne State University, ran our data for us, we were intrigued not to find some very strong correlations, because in our focus group data, we found a lot of commentary about depression and stress. And so our paper includes the fact that the qualitative data, the direct comments from the women, did not always match the analysis from the measures that we use to operationalize these concepts. And we make the case that perhaps more work needs to be done in terms of how we go about studying depression, suicide, other conditions and populations that have not always been included as a part of the subjects in a sample, but also have not been included as part of the group that make the conceptual basis for study, determine which hypotheses would be asked or what questions would be most likely reasonable and beneficial for the population and then for the sample. So we are just about to conclude, and I wanted to share with you some findings from the Kaiser Family Foundation as a way to kind of wrap this up, because we have perceptions of the general population and the lived experiences of others. And I will begin, first of all, by saying in this document, there was no mention of Native Americans or Alaska Natives or Hawaiian Natives, but primarily it was about Blacks, Hispanics, and Whites, and very little about Asian Americans. I want to acknowledge that up front and say that as we go forward, we need to think about how we include people in our study and make sure that everyone has a voice as that arc of justice bends in the direction for better health care for all. In the meantime, I would like to suggest to you that about half of the public recognize that Black Americans are more likely to get sick or die from the virus, but fewer, 36%, are aware of the disproportionate impact that the virus is having on Hispanics. And there is no mention about the impact that the virus is having on Native Americans and Alaska Natives, or Asian Americans as well. About half of Black adults, including 60% men and 30% women, say that they have been afraid that their lives were in danger because of the skin that they're in or because of their race. Remember, which is a social construct, nevertheless very powerful and very influential in everyone's lives and in all communities. This compares to about a quarter of Hispanic adults and 16% of white adults. Approximately 4 in 1 say that Black Americans are more likely to receive a poor quality of health care, less likely to be covered by health insurance, even though there seems to be a continuous effort to appeal the Affordable Care Act, and less likely to be able to access the health care that they need, either because of the fact that they don't have any insurance, because of distance, because of the lack of appropriate health literacy, etc., etc. A majority of Black adults and nearly half of Hispanic adults say that they have been treated unfairly in a variety of situations in the past 12 months because of their race or their ethnicity. So I would conclude that deaths of despair also can be interrupted, regardless of whether we're talking about rural white men who have a right to live a good, solid, productive life too, as well as all other Americans and those of us who toil every day to make life better, especially for those people who carry the burden of mental health and substance abuse and all of the other components that eventually are associated with it, the impact that it has on families and communities. I thank you for your toils. I thank you for your struggles. It is an area that produces some of the best outcomes because we all know that without solid mental health, there's hardly any health. So I thank you for your toils, for your knowledge, and ask that you look at how you can begin to identify those behaviors that you might see as antecedents to deaths of despair and nip them all in the bud. Thank you so very much, and good luck to each of you. Thank you for joining us today. On behalf of Dr. Mona Hassan and Dr. Jose Nirande, I wish to thank them for the help that they always provide for me and the support as we go forward with our research. And thank you today for joining us.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gary. It's now time for our question and answer period. Dr. Hassan, before we move on, we wanted to give you an opportunity to add anything if you did have something you wanted to say.
I wanted to say thank you very much, Dr. Gary and everyone. I have a question actually too for Dr. Gary. Do you suggest any future research for the days of despair? What should we focus on?
Well, I think Dr. Hassan, you know me well enough that I say we are going to begin to focus on prevention, which is cheaper, makes more sense, more reasonable. It provides a better life course. I think we need to focus on children, youth, families, and communities. Okay. Because if we can identify behavioral health problems or physical health problems in children and adolescents, I say the sooner the better, and put in place the kinds of mechanisms that are needed to assist them in their growth and development, and at the same time to teach the families how to care for the children with support from professionals. I think that's where we get the best outcome, because we want the children to grow and develop and to finish school and to become viable citizens. Now, thank you for asking that question, because I just want to share with you something about schools. You remember I said earlier that our colleagues at Princeton, Dr. Case and others, had said that they identified this population of men because these white men had not gone on to college. They dropped out of high school or had attained only a high school diploma and not gone forth. And she made the case about not having good jobs if you don't go on to college and have some kind of skill. And that companies are not willing to pay for workers at a certain level, and that there is no upward mobility. But let me just share with this with you. Every year, about 1.2 million students drop out of high school. One student every 26 seconds drop out of school. That's about 7,000 students a day. That's in the United States. And so we look at our colleagues from Princeton are saying about the necessity of having a high school education and some other kind of level of knowledge and skill sets. What we are doing is allowing children or not intervening, and we're setting them up for deaths of despair. I find that to be alarming. White and Asian students have the highest rates of high school completion. Black and Hispanic students have the lowest, but some level of improvement in some pockets across the United States. There was no mention in the data that I looked at about Native Americans and Alaska Native students. Again, we have to make sure that all groups are considered, because everybody's life is important. And if we're going to have a stronger America, we're going to have opportunities for everyone. White men and rural communities, as well as Native American and Alaska Native people, too.
Thanks so much, Dr. Yeri. We'll get started with our Q&A session now. Our first question from the audience is, what are considered deaths of despair?
Well, I think earlier I mentioned to you that according to these three people, they identified suicide, substance use and abuse, alcohol use, and of course that leads also to liver disease. So in the conceptualization by the individuals that I mentioned today, those indeed are the deaths of despair. That's what they conceptualize to be the deaths of despair. And I suggest that that same concept certainly could be applied to other populations. And I began to do that when I look at what was happening with Native American people. That's also in the video that I played where they describe what those researchers meant by deaths of despair.
Okay. And where does the concept of deaths of despair originate?
At Princeton University, among the economists, is Dr. Case and Dr. Denton, D-E-N-T-O-N. That's where I think it originated. Now, we also have Dr. Braveman, who's out at University of California, San Francisco, who talks about a similar phenomenon that she labels it the causes of the causes. So Dr. Braveman would say, if we want to look at, let's say, alcohol overdoses of drug overdose, let's say, by, let's say, white men in rural communities, she would say we have to look at the causes of the causes. And one way to unravel the causes of the causes, I think, is by using a conceptual framework where we look at the social determinants of health. And Kaplan's model that I shared is one such model to do that. There are many others, And if the person who asked the question would like for me to share others, I would certainly do that. And I would hasten to say that when Dr. Mona Hassan and Dr. Yaronda and I work with data about children, we use Bonfren-Reynolds, a model that's been around for a long time. You might know that he was at Harvard University and published his model maybe 30 or so years ago. When he talks about the child, the next level is interaction, the family, the community, the school, the larger community that the child lives in. So that's also another very good model for working with children and families. And also communities, because it's a model that communities can understand when they see the levels interacting with each other. And then the researcher or the clinician decides what particular area is the focus for the research or for the clinical practice or for the intervention of the more.
Okay,
but
great.
I'm happy to share others. I have a whole host of them. I'm happy to share others. So if the person just gives us the name and address, we can send a whole list of them.
And our next question is, what advice would you give for someone interested in focusing their dissertation research on deaths of despair?
I would say you could take that concept, deaths of despair, and you could use the major conditions as I have described that were based on my findings from The Economist at Princeton. Or you could take that concept and look at, let's say, a particular group. Let's say you could look at the homeless populations and you could determine among the homeless populations, let's say in Ohio, what are the most frequent kinds of conditions that lead to early deaths or preventable deaths among the homeless. And in a sense, you could frame that as deaths of despair among homeless populations in central Ohio, or however you like to do it. I think the term is a very catchy term, and it certainly caught my eye, and that's one of the reasons I decided to explore it. But you're talking about deaths, preventable deaths. And so when these deaths are preventable at across the lifespan at such young, vibrant ages, they are indeed deaths of despair. That's a very good question. Thank you for it.
Thank you. Our next question is, with this being a relatively new concept, how can this be incorporated into clinical practice?
That's also a very interesting question. Again, I think you would determine. I think it was when I was on a committee at the Joint Commission, a question would always come up with people who had queries. Well, how can you possibly say that clinicians need to be astute about the cultural practices, health beliefs of individuals who come to our hospitals and our clinics? And of course, our position was that if you work at a hospital or clinic, wherever that might be, I think you have an obligation to understand the demographic profiles of the people that you serve. So in Ohio, that population might be very different than it is if I were at my home in Florida. So who comes to your hospital for service? What percentage are Hispanic? What percentage might be Amish? What percentage might be people of African descent, Caucasian? What's the general profile? How many people have insurance? How many people don't? So you need to understand who you're giving service to. Take those data and make sure that you develop some training and accountability among all of the providers in your system. That's doctors, nurses, social workers, psychologists. And if you use the therapeutic community model, it's everyone. We don't use the therapeutic community model anymore for a variety of reasons. One reason is that patients are not hospitalized for very long, and that's a time for a different discussion, but that is a fact. They're not. They used to be hospitalized for a longer period of time, for better or for worse. And the concept of the therapeutic community that was generated by Maxwell Jones in England, I thought was very useful, and that's a very simple concept that states that everybody in the therapeutic milieu is responsible for therapy or responsible for treatment. So if you take that concept and put it into a general hospital, you would say that everyone who works at that hospital has a general understanding about the health beliefs and the cultural practices of the majority of the populations that they serve. That's very different than saying I need to know something about everybody. That's not going to happen. But I think the focus could be on who you do serve and teaching and having some accountability for those individuals. And then when you find that you don't understand information about a particular subgroup, then you have mechanisms in place where you can provide a way to address their care and their needs. And the other issue is that those hospitals and health systems that have a diverse workforce to include Hispanics, Blacks, Whites, Asians, Native Americans, I just think they're in a better position of having the potential to provide better care. And I say the potential because unless there's a specific effort to make it happen, it may not ever happen. It has to be on the radar. It has to be discussed. It has to be a goal, an objective. It has to be discussed, evaluated, improved upon. It has to be a part of what the institution stands for, its mission. And the mission must be organic.
Okay, great. And we have just one more question for you. A participant asks, so Dr. Gary seems to be saying that depression equals despair, and they're wondering if that's accurate and if you can comment on the role of shame.
Well, no, I'm glad you brought that question up. Depression does not necessarily mean despair. And if you look at the factor loadings for the three women, I never mentioned despair with them, but certainly on the Beck Depression Inventory, they're scores were mild and moderate. But if you look at the factor loadings, you saw suicide, you saw pessimism, you saw guilt, you saw tiredness and whatever. So I think we need to be very clear about that. And we have depressive symptoms, and then we have clinical depression. You have to have a bifurcation between those two concepts. So please do not think that depression automatically means despair. Now, the woman I told you I went and had the conversation with, she was working full time trying to pay her rent and whatever else. Over time, clinical depression can lead to despair and suicide. We also know that as well. Now, in our paper that we will soon publish, we also found out that the women did not embrace the concept as we know and call depression. They all said we don't have depression. And one of the inferences that we made is that the Black women work under such stressful conditions at work, at home, and in the community, it becomes a way of life. And they don't see it as something that they need to take any additional action for. We couch our discussion in spirituality. And in our next paper coming out, the notion that if one is very spiritual and truly believes in God, then seeking additional help means that you have waned with your strength in spirituality. And perhaps being very spiritual could be one of the barriers to seeking additional help and alleviating one's suffering. I think shame for some people is more prominent. I think shame in some cultures is more prominent, and guilt in some cultures are more prominent. But it can happen at any time and across cultures. And again, when you talk about shame and guilt, you also have to talk about how much, how often, and how it impacts one's activities of daily living. So without that additional information, it's only a beginning conversation. So I would suggest going further and say how often. Are you talking about a teaspoonful? Are you talking about a cupful or a jarful? What are you talking about and how do you measure it? And then ask the patient, what do you think is going on? How long do you think this would last? And how do you think it should be treated? Now, I also need to tell you that in my clinical practice, I always use Kleinman's self-explanatory model, and I don't have it in my presentation, but if you just go and Google it, Kleinman's exploratory model, it is, Kleinman is a psychiatrist and an anthropologist. And the first question is, what do you call this illness? And I would just quickly say that my colleague at the University of Florida, Dr. Regina Bussin, a psychiatrist, child psychiatrist, and I were doing focus groups with families who had children diagnosed with ADHD. And using Kleinman's model, we asked the question, what do you think caused the illness? And I'll never forget, in the first focus group, the first comment was from a mother who said, my child has ADHD because we live close to power lines. Power lines are all over our community, and that's why my child has ADHD. We published that paper, and it's in the Harvard Review of Psychiatry. I don't remember the year, but if you Google it, you'll find it. So that is the advantage of understanding the patient's perspective. Because unless you do, and unless you have conversations about how the two perspectives can help the patient, then you don't have a grasp of all of these central attributes to make a viable plan of action that is patient and client-centered, and one that can be addressed by the client, the family, and the provider.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing, Dr. Gary. We have one final comment before I conclude the webinar. Patricia says, thank you so much for presenting today. This definitely shed light to some of the disparities I was unaware of, such as that with Native Americans. There's so much to learn. And with that, we would like to thank Dr. Gary, Dr. Hassan, and you, the participants, for a great question and answer period and for joining us on this webinar today. We hope that you'll be able to utilize the information presented today to strengthen your work. In closing, we would like your feedback on this webinar. After you close the webinar window, a new window will pop up that includes a brief survey. Thank you, and please save the date for our next webinar scheduled for August 26th on the topic of culturally responsive substance use disorder treatment. Thank you. This concludes our webinar.